Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. Today's guest is Adam Gordon, and he is going to talk us through his journey from selling candidate ID, a recruitment marketing automation ATS software provider. And he's a fascinating guy. He probably one of the best sales guys in the industry, coined his own phrase on talent pipelining, and just went to market and kept doing it. So we talked a lot about that, about his own personal journey, about what's next. Adam's real engaging character and very open and honest, comfortable in his own skin. Talked about giving up alcohol. Not me. I probably need to think about that sometime, but not today. I recorded this the other week and just been flat out, so I haven't managed to get it out. But really sad news about his business partner, Scott McRae, who unfortunately passed away. So condolences to Scott, his family, his friends, and to Adam, who I know is very close. But thanks as ever to our sponsors for being behind us on this podcast. And it was great to meet you guys at both Sourcewell and Luxo at the Agency Expo, which I will talk more about later. Well, onwards and upwards, this was a really fun podcast, so I hope you guys enjoy it.
Hi, Dan Alexander here, and this episode is brought to you by Recwired, the all-in-one go-to platform for serious recruitment professionals, owners, and founders who are looking to grow their businesses. Now, we'll actually be launching the new online platform very soon, and if you'd like to be one of the first people to get access to our state-of-the-art learning platform and vault of online resources, then get in touch with us through the link in the description of this episode.
Welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. I'm joined today by Adam Gordon, newly unemployed.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you very much for having me, Dilta. It's great to see you again. It's been a few years since we did this. A lot's changed in that time.
Yeah, both of us. Adam, formerly of Candidate ID. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. That could be congratulations on selling Candidate ID. It could be congratulations on becoming unemployed. But yeah. I'll just take it for both of those. And no, thank you.
All right. Selling a software company, amazing achievement. I've been following you for a long time. And I know that you didn't just sell the company. You sold the whole idea behind the company. And you sold the talent pools and talent pipelines and talent. Like you kept repeating it all the time. You got your message out there that it's almost like it's the word is almost associated with you in the marketplace.
Yeah. When we went into lockdown in February or March 2020, after about 2 or 3 weeks of that, I was working in my dining room and my wife used to come in every couple of days and go, "How the hell can you say the same stuff over and over and over again all day, every day?" And yeah. She deliberately doesn't follow me on any social media. You know, she hadn't really heard me. You know, she hadn't been in my working in my office. So like that was the first time that we ended up being together in this. In a situation where one of us could hear the other. Yeah. And So I think that was probably the point where I realized that I've got a bit of OCD and I've got a bit of. There's quite a few things that actually allow me to just do the same thing over and over. And in fact, if I go back to talent sourcing, which is the business I did before, it was a talent sourcing business. I've got no problem sitting for like 3 hours just doing a list, building a list of like financial accountant, management accountant, software engineers with skills. You know, I can sit and do that and bang out the same thing over and over. So yeah, I said the word talent pipeline, at least a million times in 6 years.
It's funny. Yeah. My wife has she's in business with me, obviously, but she takes the office. I work from home. This podcast has made her so much money. It's built her advisory business, her community, yeah. all of that stuff. She's never once listened to it. She's never once been on it. Anyway, you do need a wee bit of that division in your life.
Yes.
How did it feel when the money hit your bank account?
Were you refreshing
the screen the whole time?
Yes, I was.
Where were you? Set the scene for me.
I can't remember where I was. I'm sure I must have been. I must have been at home. It was a Friday, and we concluded the deal on the Friday, but we couldn't announce until the Monday, because we'd missed certain deadlines on the Friday. These things take a long time. I mean, I spent all day in a legal office on the Friday, and so it would have been. On the Friday evening, sometime I'm just sitting on the couch. I know it's done. And yes, I was hitting refresh on the bank account to watch the money coming in. And it was a feeling of elation, but it was a feeling of elation over quite a long period of time because once all the paperwork had been done and the deal had been signed. You know, I knew that there was going to be a different set of digits in the bank account in a few hours' time. And so it was like elation over about a 4-hour period. And then getting up the next day going, things are different now. The world's a bit different, but I don't know how to feel about it. And honestly, it's nearly a year later and I have got a different financial status compared to a year ago. And I am only now really getting to grips with what's the best way to manage money now? What's the best way to invest? What's the best way to just structure your life and your lifestyle? I haven't changed my lifestyle very much, but it's been a very unusual experience and one that I hadn't read up on. And I really should have read up on, like, what do you do? I probably didn't want to jinx it, you know, by going and researching what's the right things to do and stuff. I did a bit of research afterwards, like kind of middle of last year. I did a bit of research, but it's taken nearly a year for the kind of dust to settle, if you like, and to feel like things are a bit more business as usual.
Tell me, you publicly were like, I'm giving up alcohol. I asked you a little bit before we jumped on. You told me that you've successfully done that. You look fit from it as well, by the way. You know, it's good to see. I go on and off it myself. I try and manage it. You know, being from the areas that we are from, in the cold and the wet and the wind and the rain. You know, it is part of our culture, so it's a difficult one. When the money hit the bank account, tell me you didn't want to have a beer. Come on, lad! You wanted to have a beer.
I didn't, to be honest.
That's amazing.
And I can't even remember. I can't even remember what I did. I don't think I really did anything to celebrate particularly. But it would have been the right time to get some champagne out. I'll tell you what. I've got a bottle of 1977 port, which is it was the second best vintage of the last millennium.
Yeah.
And I've been saving it for a special occasion, but I didn't even do it then. I did. And so about when I turned 40, I cut down quite a lot. I became a dad when I was 37. So I cut down a bit then. Turned 40, cut down a bit more. My dad died around about then. So I cut down a bit more. His culture, you're right. Like Celtic nations have got a big drinking culture. And like my dad ran a brewery. So there was a double impact of that. Yeah, like
and you got into the recruitment industry.
Yes.
And you play rugby.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Every single, like, yeah, Glasgow, dad ran a brewery, rugby, recruitment industry. Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, I like the truth is, I drank like a fish from aged about 20, somewhere middle of university through till nearly 40. And that was enough for a lifetime.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go back in the generations of my family and I can see, right, that person was a functioning alcoholic. So was that, so was that, yeah. So was that. And I just think, you know, you got to break that pattern. And, you know, I look at my kids and I'm going, I'm not going to be asking them to go and make me a loud gin and tonic, you know, 8 years old. I'm not going to be introducing them to their dad's a hero, which is what most, you know, a lot of people think about their parents, right? Especially boys and their dads. I certainly did with my dad and he did with his dad. And I just looked at my son and went, I'm not, he's not going to grow up like that as well. He's going to grow up not really knowing anything about it. And so break the pattern. We're also living in an age where things are completely different, right? So you've got access to so many more recreational, you know, activities. And we didn't when I was in, you know, I was born in 1977. So in the 90s, when I started drinking, there wasn't a lot else to do. Go to nightclubs, chase girls, play sport, drink.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything else much to do.
I have the same, I have to fill my week. Like I have to train twice a day just to make sure, like even on a Friday, I'll have a PT session in on a Friday morning. So I won't go out and have a few pints on a Thursday. So then I know Monday to Friday, okay, it was safe. And then with now at my stage, I've got the kids a lot at the weekend with Charlotte. And it's like, but let me tell you, I've got a couple of lads trips lined up now.
And yeah,
I'm ready to rock. But it's a constant balance, Max. So fair play to you. I respect you for doing it.
Let me just add one other thing to that, right? When lockdown happened and I was no longer traveling at all for events and stuff like that, I never really drank at home anyway. So that was one element of just going, actually just knock it on the head. And then another one is, there's been a real development in the technology for alcohol-free and low-alcohol beer. Mm. About probably 5 or 6 years ago, there was a big breakthrough. And see, most of the 0.0% stuff is just crap. It tastes terrible. But the 0.5% stuff, some of the IPAs and stouts and porters and sours and things you can get now are just brilliant. So I was getting mixed boxes sent to me during lockdown. And I was trying lots of different types and styles and from different breweries. And I became really, really interested with every aspect of it. And some of it tastes garbage, but some of it is absolutely beautiful. And the lack of alcohol doesn't make any difference to me anymore.
Right, let's move on to that big bag of cash you have, right? So you're there, right? And it's burning a hole in your pocket. And you've got all the distribution channels all set up from your last business. You must have all the rec tech people coming, going, will you be on my board? Will you sell my product? Will you invest in my product? Is that what the future looks like for you? Instead of like trying to come up with the next best thing yourself, being that either that conduit between or being the investor or working between private equity and the companies? Like,
yeah. So, really great question. And I have had time to think about that. You know, I spent 10 months in iSIMS doing the integration and the handover. iSIMS was a really brilliant business for me to work in. I met loads of super smart people. I learned what are the right processes and things to put in place to really enable scale at a way that I hadn't seen before, because Candidate ID was obviously much smaller than iSIMS. And I learned masses working in that organization. And you know, I also had time during that period, to look at investments and things like that. I met quite a lot of like wealth managers and people who were talking to me about different things that people do. And that gave me a good education in what's right and what's not right. And one of the things I learned really early on is I am never going to make more money than from anybody from investing in anything, unless I'm really lucky with some crazy like invention or crypto or something where I hit it at the right time and it's just an absolute fluke. I am never going to make more money out of putting my money into a wealth fund, a hedge fund, a venture capital fund, investing in individual other people's businesses, as I will by backing myself and investing myself and you know, investing my time in developing things. And Candidate ID as a business, we did a lot of things right. And we did some things that I wouldn't necessarily do quite the same way. The product itself is absolutely brilliant. how we got it to the place we got it to, you know, we made a few decisions where it was probably the right decision at the time. But with hindsight, if I was building another business, I wouldn't necessarily make the same decisions that we made. And so, you know, this is not about, this comment's not about any individuals, because all the individuals we had in that business were really great people. But I firmly believe that keeping your business as small as possible for as long as possible is the right thing to do, because you go faster and you should only hire when you absolutely have to. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs make the mistake of thinking the more people I've got in this business, the more successful this business is. And those two things are not. And I probably get that from my background in recruitment agency world and in services businesses, where actually the more people you have, the more money you're probably making. And that doesn't necessarily translate to a tech business at all. So, you know, I made quite a lot of mistakes. But anyway, yes, what I've done is I left iSIMS at the end of January, and I will be building another recruitment tech company later this year. And in the meantime, I'm working with no more than six companies on a paid for basis around the things that I can really add a lot of value and charge them a real premium rate for me doing it. And those two things are talent pipelining. How do you build talent pipelines? And that's for enterprise employers. It's for banks and utilities companies and things like that. And then the other audience for that is HR tech businesses who don't have any competing products, or not competing with iSIMS, for example. I wouldn't want to work with companies that are competing with iSIMS. And there's lots of HR tech out there who, if they want to understand better what their positioning should be ahead of trying to scale for sales and marketing or for investment raising, then I can charge them a premium rate for working with them and providing advisory. But I'm only doing that with a very small number, because I only want to spend a very small amount of my time doing that. Most of my time, apart from going to the gym and hanging out with my family, is actually working with people who have got ideas. They're at a really early, they've either just got an idea, they've just got a deck, they've maybe got an MVP, or they've got a very early set of customers who they're either not charging people for yet, or they're just charging a really small rate just to kind of get the ball rolling. And for free, giving them some guidance and my advice around how should they go about positioning, how should they go about raising investment, how should they go about structuring, who is their actual target audience?
Sweat equity, and, as we call it.
Well, it's not sweat equity. I'm not taking any equity at all in any of these businesses. I don't want to take any, because if I do, that would be I'm not going to at all, because there would be if I did that, there would be an ongoing burden on my time by myself to continue to provide value for them. And once I start my next business, I'm not going to want to have any commitments to anything. So people have been talking to me about non-exec type stuff, and I was thinking about it, and I've met a few people, and then I've just gone, actually, no, I don't want to do that, because that's a medium term commitment. And I don't want to by the time that I start my next business, I don't want to have to, you know, have an hour that is dedicated to anything apart from that. But some of the small, really early stage people that I'm talking to, really early stage businesses I'm talking to and providing some guidance to, I'm just saying to them after half an hour, you need to shut this idea down. It's terrible. It's not going to work for this reason and this reason. And then there's others where I'm going, your idea is terrible, but you are brilliant. And if you tweak it in this way, that's a good idea. And then there's others where I'm going, you're brilliant and your idea is brilliant, or your idea is brilliant, but you're not, and you need some, you know, people in there. And for me, it's really intellectually stimulating. I love that very, very first, you know, the first 6 months, first year of any business idea. Right. I love that stage. It's so much fun.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, a masterstroke of what you did was, I saw that you crowdfunded from the community. Yeah. Did you need the money at the time, or did you do it to bring in more PR, or what was the thought process and what was the outcome of doing that?
We needed a much smaller amount of money than we raised.
Right.
So so we needed.
Take me back to where did the idea come from?
Yeah. So I'll tell you where the idea came from. It came from people in our industry, people like founders and CEOs of recruitment agencies, people in who had made money out of recruitment technology, people in talent acquisition, had over about a 6 month period, once we started our popularity started, like, and our profile started growing, we had people coming to us saying, hey, look, if there was an opportunity to invest like $5,000 into your business, that'd be really great. You know, I'd love to do it. We had at that point taken $500,000 of investment from a angel investor, high net worth in our industry, based in Germany. And the next step was always going to be a VC route, the traditional venture capital investment route. But when there was one guy in particular who at the time was leading technology at one of the major RPOs, who said, look, if I could get involved, I'd really love to. And he talked about, you know, he told us the number that he'd be interested in getting involved in. And that was the point where I went, hang on, if you add up these five people that have said this in the last couple of months, that comes to probably about $50,000 to $100,000, something like that. Why don't we, and we weren't planning to do that because it was going to get scrappy with the cap table and all that. We didn't want that many, you know, individual investors. But then we went, actually, if we flip this around and turn this into an active strategy and look to sell no more than 4% of our company or whatever, then we could probably bring in like 50 people here who are influential. And we've then got them on speed dial. They'll take our call. They'll come to our focus groups. They'll come to our, you know, they'll send people to us. They might buy our product as a, you know, as a service.
Yeah, no, it opened my mind completely. When you did it, I was like, what is this? What's he up to here? And then I was like, I started peeling back the onion a little bit.
Well, we needed about $100,000, I think, between the initial investment we took from Andy Burica from Jacobo Invest in Berlin. He invested $500,000, and we needed about another $100,000 to get us to the point where our annual recurring revenue was such that the venture capital firms we were talking to were going to say, yeah, okay, let's do this now. And so it was just like, it was almost like a bridging kind of, you know, it was like a bridging amount of investment we needed. But then, so we just decided to go for it. We put down the minimum on CrowdCube, which is $50,000, because if we got, you know, if we, you know, fell on our faces, we'd look really stupid doing this so publicly. The minimum number was 50. We were very confident we would get 50. So if you get 49,999, by the way, it fails.
Wow.
So if you get £1 less than you've set out as the target, you don't get anything and you fail, you know, and you need to hide your head in shame and probably go do something different. So we didn't want to risk that. So that's why we went with the absolute smallest number. But we decided we'll just do $100,000. That's it. But then we were at $100,000 by like 24 hours or something in the first 24 hours. We went, shit, we need to just see what happens here. So anyway, we capped it at 500. We did 500. I think we did 280 on CrowdCube, something like that. And we created a vehicle for US investors who are not allowed to invest in a UK crowdfunding platform. Yeah. So we did about 220 from some high net worth investors in the US, people in our industry. Some of them have said publicly they invested, people like Tim Sackett and Aaron Matos and Adam Godson. And these people were great for our profile, great sounding boards and wonderful to have in the business. So would I do that again? Yeah, I maybe would do that again. And it would be a very active thing. It was a good thing to do.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. Wanted to flesh that out. Really, really, really interesting. So the new company, keeping that up your sleeve for now, I'm sure.
I am constantly just evaluating like what's out there, what's needed, what's not needed. The world does not need another applicant tracking system. It doesn't need another CRM. It doesn't need more video solutions. It doesn't need more programmatic advertising solutions.
Doesn't need any more diversity and inclusion people either, because everybody was selling that last year.
Yeah. that's an interesting one, because, do you know, that is not cracked. No matter how much money and people and, you know, smart brains go into that, that is not cracked. It's not for me. It's not for me to. I am supporting some companies in that space, because as a white middle-aged man who grew up with a swimming pool in the garden and went to boarding school, I think it's really important for me to help in any way I can in terms of leveling the playing field, because I got every privilege going. I'll tell you what I am constantly doing, and that is looking at sales, looking over the fence at sales and marketing technology.
Sure.
And going, like, some of this is not really applicable to recruitment or talent, you know, agency or in-house world, but there's things over there that could be adapted. And, you know, that's what we did with Candidate ID. Marketing automation was not a new category of software, but it was a new adaptation of it, positioning it for recruitment. So I've got a bit of experience in reapplying an existing technology, which is more mature in another industry, into the recruitment TA world. And the next one will probably look similar to that.
Okay. You abandoned us in the agency world, didn't you?
I did. And here's why. So there's two phases of this, right? So the first phase was, we launched Candidate ID in January 2017. And our customers from then right up to the pandemic were probably about 50-50 agencies and in-house talent acquisition. That phase, that like first 3 years, that phase, we had a rate card, which our talent acquisition customers all paid. I think all paid. We had, I don't think we had any agency customers who were paying us rate card, because
What's a rate card? Sorry.
Like the pricing, standard pricing. Okay. And I don't think we had any recruitment agency customers who were paying us standard pricing. They had all mandated a discount, or they weren't buying. And so here's one, something I'm never doing again. When you're building something new, your temptation often is, this is advice for any first-time founders out there, the temptation is to say yes to every customer, to say yes to every product amendment they want, feature, you know, additional feature they want, and to every time they ask for a 50% discount before they say yes. And, you know, I was really soft with all of that and said yes to all of it. And I did it because we were iterating, we were trying to learn. You know, there was a lot of different things that were beneficial to us in taking on every type of customer, from a 5-person business through to a major enterprise employer. And that's where a lot of mistakes happened. So, you know, our agency customers refused to pay us the rate that our in-house team customers paid. And then from the start of the pandemic, over that first 6 months, we lost, I think, all of our agency customers. I think every single one. Some of them went bust and couldn't pay anymore. Some of them, when their contract ended, they didn't renew it. And some of them, when they basically forced us into a position where they just said, we're not paying anymore and we don't care about your contract. So that was in 6 months, and we lost a lot of business, as did most organizations in that first 6 months. Most people had a real bloodbath, but then it forced us to think about, who's our ideal customer profile? And once we realized that it's not agencies, it's definitely in-house teams, they're happy to pay our pricing, they aren't churning, whereas the agencies are. And then we got deeper and deeper into, hang on, the ones that are scaling up here are all in tech and healthcare. And we worked out that our ideal customer, and they're all in the UK and the USA. So we got from the point of beginning of the pandemic, we were providing our technology to everybody who was happy to pay something for it, to within probably about 9 months, we realized enterprise employers in tech and healthcare in the UK and USA, probably from about 1,000 to 50,000 people. Every minute we spent with companies like that, we were selling more than every minute we spent with anybody else. And we just went, we've got to focus on that.
Yeah.
And we did. We did. And my co-founder, Scott McCray, was on fire for the entire 2021 selling candidate ID to tech and healthcare companies of that size in those countries. And, you know, that learning of what wasn't working was absolutely, you know, it was gold dust information.
So tell me, ChatGPT came out recently.
Yeah.
What's the story? When's it all? Is it going to change? Is it going to finish us all off? What does the future look like? How's things going to change?
I mean, it doesn't change what I've said for a long time, which is the role of a. I do believe there is a future with less human recruiters doing 360 degree recruitment, because so many of. I mean, there is still so many people doing the same job I was doing in the same way, almost the same way as I was when I started in 1999.
Yeah.
That is getting less. 360 degree recruitment's not something I believe in at all, because I think the skills needed to do that job are so varied that unless you're a one person band or you are a very small business with like 3-4 people or something, you should be segmenting the tasks. So talent sourcing, as in looking under all the rocks to find people, is not at all the same skill set as negotiating an offer. You know, it's a completely different set of skills and probably a different mind that is perfect for doing those two different tasks. So technology in its entirety is going to, and is already taking over the repetitive tasks, the tasks that don't need human emotion in them, the tasks that don't need a huge amount of skill. I mean, this is all happening, and ChatGPT is going to do precisely the same. It's just going to accelerate that. And I say ChatGPT there as a catch-all for any, automatic content build technologies. When I started in recruitment, nearly everything I was doing was using my voice to achieve influence. The only writing I did was the writing that I put onto a fax that would go to the customer with somebody's CV. The way the CV was laid out for optimum impact, and the 2-3 sentence advert I put in the lineage advert I put in the back of the Herald, that was it. I wasn't typing anything. There was no other text. It was all, the rest of it was all completely voice driven. If I think about the way that recruitment is today, I reckon it's probably much more 80% text and 20% using your voice to achieve.
Yeah, I think it's probably 10% using your voice. And then image, text, video.
Yeah. And that goes right from the first stage outreach message, when you've identified somebody who's perfect on LinkedIn and you send them an email. It goes right from that through to the message that you send somebody on WhatsApp a month after they've started to get them to agree to do a 15-minute catch-up call with you to confirm they're happy with their job and stuff like that, and everything in between. There's at least 20, if not 50, different unique scenarios in there where you need to communicate digitally. And I think ChatGPT and tools like this, which help you build things in rapid time, are going to give us a massive head start, but I don't think that they are. I don't think that the 10% of finesse that a skillful human can put onto it is what the humans are going to need doing.
Yeah, and the ability to quarterback it, to be able to manage what's happening with the ChatGPT at every stage, and to set that up and to be the point person within that. And
totally agree with that. Your quarterback in it is a very good analogy. The way I think about it is, I said a few minutes ago that, you know, the world is going to have less recruiters. It is. It's not necessarily going to have less humans in our industry, though. So I think that there's going to be a lot more people whose job is experience design. And, you know, that is what do I want somebody to see and or hear? How do I want them to feel? And what's the next step I want them to take as a result? And design every element of that from what does something look like? Does it sound like? What does it smell like? It could be. You know, it could be, what does it smell like? When I walk into the reception, you know, if it smells of bread or it smells of, I don't know, beer, you know, what is going to get more people agreeing to the job? Mm. You know, that's a ridiculous example, but you know
no,
what I mean?
I get it. Like if I was to look, because I like to look at this stuff as well. I always like to look at stuff I can get off my plate so I can do the interesting stuff like talk to you. But one of these, it was, so if I have a VA doing my sourcing on LinkedIn, they're booking in a call and that goes from LinkedIn. So before that, I have marketing doing their thing.
Yeah.
Chopping up all the stuff that we have and all of that, that targeting all the data that we've got within our specific thing. Then I've got a VA bringing that to the person as well. Then the call gets booked in, goes to WhatsApp. Then before the call comes into me on WhatsApp, I'm in a group with them. They get the preparation of what to expect. Then the call happens and then they get the thing afterwards that's automated of what they get. Then they get, here's your options. Here's all the podcasts that we've done with these people. Here's what we think might be suitable. Go away, have a look, come back to me with that. Then it's the coordination piece back and forth where somebody else does that. Then it's the invoicing, the references, all of that where somebody else is doing that. So I, in essence, am just doing that one piece, which is at the start of the process. And then at the very end of the process, let's discuss where we're at, all of that. And I've always tried to break that down as bit by bit. What I suspect is the virtual assistants are going to get, their jobs are going to get less and less as the technology piece grows. So
I agree. What you've just described there, you've set up a system where you've automated and outsourced all the bits that are not really valuable enough for you to be spending your time on.
Everything but influence.
Exactly. So you can optimize your time on the things that's the most valuable and important for you. You are probably in our industry, you will be in the top 5% or maybe even top 2% or 1% of like people who are savvy enough to do all of those things. It's going to come en masse. We're all going to be, you know, in 10 years' time, probably 30% of people are going to be doing it like Dilta's doing it.
Yeah.
But it's going to take time.
Well, yeah. So we set up our advisory practice off the back of it. My wife delivers that. And we've coached a load of recruiters and startups, like one-man bands mainly. She also does bigger business advisory now. But for this practice, to copy this, it's a one-man band system. And there's guys, they're making 250, 350. You know, it's them and two VAs. And Amazing. They're doing a couple hours a day. And they're like, I feel guilty that that's doing. But it's the organization and the being systematic and understanding every stage and making sure that every stage is owned by either a system, a technology, or a person. And it works. Now, does it scale out? It depends on how much influence and can you teach people to do that one piece of influence? And then can the business generate enough of the engine to make things happen? So that's the challenge.
I'm guessing you're a Tim Ferriss fan.
Well, that's where it started from years ago. Like that
got me thinking. Yeah. 4-hour work week really got me thinking about
it. Got me thinking. Yeah. I was in because I'd left my first agency job in Robert Walters in Australia and we were backpacking and I came across it. And even before that, I remember sitting at the desk and going, you know, I'm in a suit. It's fucking boiling outside. I'm in a mining town in Perth in Western Australia. Like, and they're asking me to go out and meet somebody for a coffee that I met last quarter. I don't need to be doing that. I used to just sit at my desk and bill. And then I was like, why am I doing all this admin? that should be somebody else. You're paying, like, I think they were paying me $70,000, $80,000. Like, that's loads of money back then. I was like, you're paying me loads of money and you're making me do admin. Like, surely that this can't be right. And I'm not even good at admin. Like, and you're wanting me to spend my time. So it got me thinking. And then luckily my wife is very organized and like is very, very admin. So she could train all her own team of admins in the Philippines and make all of that happen. So
yeah,
get to that stage. Before you go, I want to ask you, so big bag of cash we've talked about. And lots of interest in things that you could possibly do. And you're analyzing where you're going to move to in the world.
Yeah.
What was the criteria? Because we've both been through this, right? So
yeah.
I'm on the other side of it without all the money. But I'll tell you my list first.
Yeah.
So safety, because we've kids.
Yeah.
Good education, nice weather, and proximity to family, and logistically easy, and a good tax regime.
So, for anybody that doesn't know about this, but the background is I have been thinking the last probably 5 months, I've been thinking about going and spending a year or maybe longer living elsewhere for life experience for my kids. And we're lucky to be able to have the opportunity to go and do that. The only reason we're not doing it this summer, so we'd have to do it starting in the school at the summer school holiday, for changing schools and stuff like that. The only reason we're not doing this summer is I've had too many things happening, and actually just clearing our house to allow somebody else to move into it to rent it out for a year or 2 years is just too much of a challenge with all the other stuff that's been happening. But we are going to do it, definitely. And my criteria was warmth. My wife's criteria was not too much warmth. So we're thinking like ambient climate, averaging low to mid 20s all year round would be great. Like lows in winter of 21 and highs in summer of 25, 26. That would be incredible. A lot of the same ones as you though, safety, outdoors lifestyle, a lot of activities, like culture around sport. I'm not big into like tennis and golf and things like that, but I love team sports in particular. The kids do. Water is a criteria, like looking at the water, waking up every day and you're at the water, is one which is really important. And the one that we got to as being possibly closest to what we're looking for is Madeira.
Except I just ruined it for you.
Although you've just given me a good sense that actually it's maybe a bit boring after a few months of being there. So I think we definitely do need to go out for like a week or something and check it out and see what we think it's going to be like. But yeah, I mean, proximity to like, I really love London. I mean, I really love London. I really love New York because on any night of the week, you can go and see world-class entertainment.
Yeah.
It could be world-class sport. It could be world-class music. It could be world-class drama, you know, and the stuff going on all the time. And I probably don't need that. But at the same time, if Madeira's got like nothing going on, then that's going to be pretty boring after a few months, I would expect.
At the risk of being an advertisement board for Gibraltar, I would narrow down. I would, if I'm analyzing all that stuff that you're saying, I would look at Porto or Lisbon. And there's a place called Foz do Douro in Porto that would make sense, where you could really live like it's like California, and it's just north of the city. And then there's north of the city in Lisbon as well, Cascais.
I've been there and I absolutely love it. The landscape's amazing. The sea's amazing. It's not boiling like it is in some other parts of the world around there. So that's not a bad option. Gibraltar sounds like an option. You know, I know somebody else who lives there as well and they rave about it. You rave about it.
Yeah, love it, right? Well, even if not here on the Spanish side, so the like Soto Grande or something like that. So tomorrow I'm going to start the day by jumping in the sea, and I'm going to finish the day on the slopes in Granada. So like, it's always something I've said I wanted to try and do in the one day. And so that's going to be the latest vlog is
Sierra Nevada, right?
Sierra Nevada. I've been up three times this year. So it's a 3-hour drive from here. I've met my buddies up there. I'm doing this with my parents and my kids. And I went up just over Christmas with Charlotte. So we spent a bit of time in Granada and then up there. But from here, you can get, obviously you can get to Malaga, but Tarifa is an amazing town. You have all of that coastline over to Portugal, which is accessible. You have the mountains that are just on the other side of the border. You have Marbella if you want a bit of trash.
Vilamoura if you want a bit of trash.
Yeah. And there's 3 flights a day from here to London.
I flew in to Gibraltar to go to the Rangers game in the Europa Cup final in Seville. Seville's the hottest place I've ever been to. And that was, I think, May last year.
Yeah.
And that was too in hot. The 40s. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. I went September, I can't remember, but it was okay. But even then I was like, oh, this is too hot. Seville's too hot, but down here you'd be surprised it's not as hot. But yeah, make it happen.
Absolutely, and you're a big inspiration for that.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, look, great chatting to you again. Really love seeing people do well. Love seeing people start something and get their day in the sun, and it all comes true. And you know, you did the work, and you coined the phrase, and you made it happen. And you know, how many air miles did you clock up in those 5 years? Even though with COVID brought into it,
I mean, it's funny you say that, because actually, last night I used up the last of my Avios on a flight to London in May. And I'm only going to a gig. I'm not going for any other reason. I'm not traveling for work anymore.
Yeah.
That changed my lifestyle so much. I was traveling every single week. I was really, really burnt out and hadn't realized. So, you know, the pandemic, I wouldn't have wished it, you know, looking back, I wouldn't have wished it to happen. It was a terrible thing, devastating so many people and lives and businesses. But for me personally, it worked out so damn well. I sleep a lot better. I'm a lot healthier, fitter, all that stuff. I don't know I don't know how many air miles I did, but it was about 50% blood, sweat, and tears, and a lot of that was in the air miles.
Very good, Adam. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Cheers, Delta.